require from our parents, from our societies. And being able to get perspective on that, all that we are conditioned by, the attitudes, assumptions, both good and bad, right and wrong, that are part of a programming system. Because like when a baby's born, you know, it has a human form, human baby form is conscious, but it doesn't have any ego yet, it doesn't have a language, but it's a fully conscious human form that is then, conditioned by, through its identities, through the mother, the father, the family, the ethnic background, religion, the class structures of society. We acquire all these identities through our childhood. And then meditation, when we're using this word, which is a kind of generic word for almost any kind of mental activity, but in a Buddhist sense, it's the ability to pay attention, to awaken, and not just operate from positions that we acquire, or attitudes or assumptions that are part of a social or cultural conditioning, but to awaken to the ultimate reality. So when people ask me, like defining the word Dhamma, this is a Buddhist term we use for reality. What's true and real, ultimately true and real? And we awaken to that through this practice of meditation, through reflection, through attention, through patient observing, through our ability to bear with the conditions we acquired, both the physical, mental, emotional, our own memories, thoughts, character tendencies, and so forth. We're not so interested in trying to change them, but to recognize them in terms of reality. And so this is the Buddha's genius, was pointing at the nature of conditioned phenomena, all that arises, ceases, all that, and this is what we're experiencing now. We're experiencing the physical body. You all have physical bodies at this moment. You're all in a posture, sitting, and you're breathing, inhaling, exhaling. You're feeling, you're feeling hot or cold, or comfortable or not comfortable. Emotionally, what are you feeling right now? Maybe, you feel interested or bored or happy or sad or whatever. But our ability to observe these conditions that we're experiencing in the present is the awakening to ultimate reality, to reality itself, or in Buddhist terms, awakening to the Dhamma. Now, most of us come, whatever country, whatever culture you're from, we get conditioned by that. So we acquire the attitudes, the biases, the prejudices, the assumptions of our culture, of our parents, usually. At first, the mother usually has the strongest influence in the beginning, and then the father, the peers, brothers, sisters, family, and so forth, we develop a sense of our self-worth, a sense of our position within the social structure, within the family. And all this is conditioned, it's coming from a programming that you absorb, because like a newborn child, his mind is pure consciousness. Consciousness is pure, it's not sullied in any way, its nature is purity. And then we become conditioned to identify, first of all, like with the bodies we have. So we're strongly identified with the form, with the physical form. And then that is, and then later on with its appearance, whether it's male or female, whether it's light or dark, whether it's beautiful or not, or with the age of the body, and these are acquired conditions that we get after we're born. So what I'm doing now, just pointing to what is natural, that isn't created by a society, by a culture, by a religion, by anything at all, but it's just natural phenomena, is the bodies you have are the natural phenomena. Consciousness is natural phenomena. This is a sense realm we're living, you know, when you understand what you're up against in this life, we're continuously experiencing pleasure, pain, pleasure, or some kind of sensory impingement on these forms, through seeing, through hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And then we also have this ability to reflect. We have language, we have retentive memory. So we have to, we remember things of the past. We have a language which we learn after we're born. Nobody's born with a language. And that language, whether it's English or French or Thai or Chinese or whatever, is something that we acquired, you know, through the cultural conditioning and education. And we tend to use language. We become very attached to our ability to think. And of course, modern life now is very much, you know, worships the idea of reason, logic, the ability to create, make sense out of conditioned phenomena through thinking, through labeling, through fixing identities with experience, with memory. And this also becomes very much a strong sense of a self-view, a separate self that we tend, in the long run, isolate. The more sense we have of ourself as a unique phenomenon, then the more lonely we become, because we aren't connected, we don't feel connected to the whole, we feel isolated within the forms we have. And of course, the forms, you know, they age and they have illnesses, disabilities, and all kinds of problems. The human forms change, and some people are born with disabilities and forms that aren't, you know, that if you identify with it, you aren't going to be very happy about it. But this identity is also an illusion. We're not this body. This body is a natural form, like the trees, like the flowers, like the animal kingdom, the mosquitoes, the flies. All these are forms in nature, conscious forms. Now this is just for you to reflect on. I'm not trying to convert you or convince you of anything. This is up to just to consider what consciousness really is. The reality of consciousness. Because this is a subject that people are really, really interested in at this time in the Western world. What is consciousness? Now we're all conscious at this moment. We're all experiencing it. But we tend to, because of our conditioning, we don't notice pure consciousness. We aren't aware of it. In its purity, because we're always creating a sense of ourself, our loves, our hates, our fears, desires, emotional problems, habits that we are aligned with, are identified with. And so these conditions, they come and go in consciousness. But what holds all of this together at this moment, where we're unified at this very moment, here and now, is consciousness. Because this consciousness is oneness. It holds us together as conscious. But then we separate through, I'm Ajahn Sumedho, you're somebody else. This is the reality we believe in, that this separation is the real world. And so religion, you know, the main function of religion really is to bring us back to that oneness, that wholeness, that we have forgotten. It's not that we lose it or we don't have it, we just don't notice it, we don't know what it is, because we're so programmed, so caught up in identifying, in loving, hating, liking, disliking, and right and wrong, good and bad, that we're caught in this cycle, in this whirlpool of conditioning. So when we practice meditation, like sitting still, noticing your breath, bringing attention to that which is happening here and now. You know, what is it, you know, we're all sitting, we're in posture, most of us are. Sitting, either sitting or walking or standing, lying down, four postures. We're all breathing. And so these are, when we begin to take an interest in meditation and developing, in order to recognize, to appreciate, to relate, to be in that pure conscious knowing state again, without all of the conditions pulling us into various feelings of happiness or sadness, good and bad, right and wrong. When we are mindful, like the word mindfulness is the term used a lot, awareness. It's ability that we have to connect back to pure consciousness. Before it, you know, and to be able to do that, then is really wonderful that this is possible. We're not just helpless victims of the conditioning process, of helpless victims of our physical bodies or our cultural conditioning or our personalities or whatever. And if there was no way out of this turmoil, this whirlpool of conditioning, then meditation wouldn't be able to do it. But when the Buddha was enlightened, say in this tradition, you know, in the ancient time, 2000. In Thailand, they consider that Buddha lived 2,557 years ago. What is it that he recognized when he was enlightened? And if you read in the scripture, the actual history, biography of the historical Buddha, you know, like old traditions, he was a very fortunate, born to a royal family, well educated, had all the advantages of his society at that time, both in wealth and in position. And the father, you know, these sages predicted that this prince, this young prince, Prince Siddhartha, would either become a Buddha or a world emperor. And of course his father, like most fathers, want their sons to become world emperors. I think my father would rather I become world emperor than he would be really proud of me if I could have done that. Because, you know, this is the worldly view, to be a powerful figure, you know, holding the power and being the most important person in the room, is one thing. But being a Buddha, what is that? You know, we can raise that perception to being like a god or some superlative type of personality. Or what it means is one who sees clearly. Like the word Buddha is it's not personal. It's not a personal identity. If our ability, every one of us, have this ability to awaken to reality. And so, when he changed from Prince Siddhartha, left the palace, he became awake, while he was a prince, you know, he broke the rules, and he decided to go out of the palace, which he was forbidden to do, went in secret, to explore life in the world outside, and saw old old person bent over with age, a corpse, human corpse, a sick person, you know, with pain and sickness, and an ascetic, a monk or a samana or ascetic, sitting under a tree. So in the Theravada school, these are considered the four heavenly messengers. Four heavenly messengers. So one time somebody asked me, you know, like Christian asked me one time about, do Buddhists have angels? And I said, well, what are Christian angels like? And he said, you know, they play the harp, they're white, they're beautiful, they have wings. I said, what are Buddhist angels like? And I said, old person, corpse. So just reflect on that, because these are awakening, you know, like you know, at my age now, I'll be 80, and this is like still, it's like awakening to the reality of age. You know, the body age is a mindless age. You know, the mind still thinks it's not old, and then the body keeps letting me know that the body's not young anymore. But I can still think like a young person. And when I'm not noticing the body, I can even feel young. Several years ago, I had a chance to, I was visiting Egypt, and we wanted to climb Mount Sinai. And so we had to leave at night, you know, from Sharm el-Sheikh, a resort there on the Red Sea, and took a coach up to St. Catherine's, this very ancient Christian monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai. And then we had to hike from about midnight up Mount Sinai, and I couldn't do it. My body just refused to cooperate. My mind was wanting to get up to the top before dawn. That's what you're supposed to do. And when I was younger, I used to be able to force, even when tired and exhausted, I could still will my body to move. But I couldn't even do that. The body absolutely refused to move. So they put me on a camel. I had to ride a camel to Mount Sinai. And then this is, you know, the mind and the body. Now, this is a reflection, like seeing the body as a teacher rather than as a personal identity. Because in modern life, most in Western culture, people find aging something they don't like, don't want, and people want to be young. And we identify strongly with what we look like, with the age of the body. And so this creates a form of suffering. We don't want to be old, we don't want to get sick, we don't like to look at corpses, we don't like to be reminded of death. And then the samana, or the monk, or the holy person, who is actually meditating inside of, is another archetype. You know, that means this is a way of dealing with the natural flowing experience of life from birth to death, from young to old. And when we do this, then we see the suffering we create through these false identities. Because they are. Whatever you think you are at this moment, you're not that. What you think is the condition that arises, whatever you're thinking right now about yourself, don't believe it. It is what it is. I'm not saying it's wrong or right, but it's from memory, it's conditioned, and if you don't see it in that perspective, then it can carry away. You can get happy or sad, elated or depressed by just holding on to these thoughts, these feelings, these moods, these personal identities, and then you are victim of your conditioning process, which is kind of helplessly caught in the momentum sometimes our conditioning isn't very good, is it? If we don't have very good parents or life has not been particularly fair or good to us, if we've been abused or misunderstood or unloved, we, you know, these are not conditions that help us to feel happy about ourselves. But even with the best conditions, even with good parents and wealth and opportunities, it's still based on ignorance, the self-view. I'm not asking you to believe this. This is for reflection, consideration. Are you really the physical form you're experiencing in this moment? Are you really what you're thinking? Are you really the memories that you have? Your emotional habits and proclivities, your identities, these come and go, arise and cease continuously throughout your life. They're changing phenomena. And the Buddha pointed out that all we need to know is they are phenomena, or condition, or Pali word sankharas. Sankhara, like condition phenomena, is this realm we're living in. It's about sensitivity. It's about the day was a very hot day. And people in Seattle aren't used to hot weather, I don't think. people are quite surprised when Seattle gets hot like this, but we're experiencing heat and then we have reaction. We either like it or don't want it. We want to hope that it stays or we hope that it goes. We react to the feeling of being hot. And this may vary from one person to the next. It's not we all have the same reactions to heat or cold. But this knowing, this mindfulness then, is the way that we can know the nature of phenomena as change rather than in terms of how we're conditioned to perceive it. You know, me and mine, good and bad, right and wrong. And so this is our gift of our humanity, this humanity that we all share at this time. We have animal-like bodies, we aren't that much different from chimpanzees, gorillas, apes, animal kingdom, we all have the same instincts, procreating the species, self-preservation. We all feel tired, we have emotions of happiness and sadness. We all want to live, we don't want to die. These we share, we have hunger and thirst. We share this with all creatures. But the problem of our humanity lies in our ignorance. By identifying with all these conditions, we become very confused and frightened and neurotic. And we can abuse and fight and have wars, as you know. If you just read the news in one day, it's about endless conflicts, battles between different ways of thinking, different religious groups or ethnic groups. Different nationalities. So this conflicting tendency in all of us because we're strongly fixed in these assumptions. We're not awake to reality or to Dhamma. Now Dhamma includes all the variations of conditioned phenomena. It's not a critical function. It's not saying there's anything right or wrong about them. It's just noticing, paying attention to the common characteristic that they're all changing. So this is what awareness, mindfulness, and in Pali they use sati sampajanya, which means mindfulness. They translate sampajanya as clear comprehension or intuitive awareness. It's like mindfulness' ability to be present just in this moment, just to be here. And this doesn't mean we need to be mindful of an object, per se. Because we are mindful of objects when we have to write a letter or cross a street, drive a car. We all have to, you know, just self-preservation demands a certain level of mindfulness. Otherwise, none of us would have lived through childhood if we were continually heedless. You know, so there's a self-preservation intelligence operating in us, in which we're mindful of danger, and if you've been in dangerous physical danger, you know, it's surprising the kind of response one can have when your actual life is threatened by an external object. So this is, but this satipatthana isn't about so much an awareness of one object, but includes everything in this moment. Like we can do certain tranquility practice where we focus just on the breath, excluding everything else. That's like samatha bhavana, or developing samatha concentration, where you fix your attention on one object and at the exclusion of everything else. And then the mode of vipassana is opening to the totality of this moment, which includes everything. So one point in concentration oftentimes is interpreted as just focusing on one object and absorbing into it by excluding everything else, which is certainly a good kind of mental exercise, but it's not the escape from suffering, because it doesn't really awaken us to reality, but it kind of modifies our ignorance and become more refined and pleasant until we awaken. And so this moment is the moment of awakening, and this sampatthanya, this intuitive embracing of the moment, it's like it's one-pointed, but the point that includes everything, good or bad, right or wrong, everyone here, everything, the building, the space. This is a reflection, not a doctrine. And then you focus on one thing. You have to concentrate today on the microphone. You have to exclude everyone else. That's one way. That's one-pointed object. One-pointedness in this way is on the totality, the wholeness, the oneness. And this we can actually do through this mindfulness, means our ability to do that, to not be just helplessly bound into objects, either external or internal. You know, we're not, you know, obsessed with our new Mercedes-Benz. We can be obsessed with our own problems, personal fears or doubts or worries. You know, modern society is affluent countries. We don't have so much worries and problems around the external things as the worries we create in our mind about me and mine, and we have, you know, a lot of freedom and affluence and things like this. And when we lived in other countries where people don't have that, they have a lot of problems with that from without. But right now, in this moment, there's no external problem, you know, unless you want to create one, like the siren. They just passed by, and you felt aversion to it. That's something you create. But in this moment, it includes, if the siren is going, this is included. It belongs in this moment. Everything you think, or feel, or remember is included. And this awakenness, this mindfulness, satipatthanya, or mindfulness and clear comprehension, or intuitive intuition, or apperception. The English word apperception, the ability to embrace all perceptions in one moment, here and now. And so this is something that's quite, this is actually the gate, the door that opens us to this deathless reality, to ultimate truth. It doesn't seem like much in terms of quantity, or can you hold it up? We're so programmed by our belief in time as reality. You really believe in time, even I have problems. I've watched the clock. I'm on a schedule, I have a program, calendars, diaries. I've got an iPad, right? I have all the appointments. You know, I can put into this magical machine that I was given. Because we live in the illusion of time as reality, that we are this human form, this is me and mine. I am my thoughts, my feelings, my memories. And then we judge ourselves, you know, like one thing I found living in England for so many years. I lived there longer than I've lived anywhere else. Teaching meditation to the British or to Europeans. There's so many, so much self-criticism. Such a sense of that they're not good enough, that they have to get something they don't have, there's something wrong with the way they are. They've made mistakes in the past, they feel guilt about things they remember in the past. They oftentimes dwell on their inadequacies or their feelings of inferiority or fears, anxieties. And yet, you know, most of them come from affluent situations, you know, educated, intelligent people. But we're not really offered an occasion to understand in terms of totality, but we're programmed to believe in time as reality, to believe in the separate self as the ultimate reality, as the real world. And if we don't question that, if we don't have any other way of looking at it, then we are kind of programmed early in life, and that takes us through to death. If we live 100 years, we're still operating from ignorance and false views. But also, this opportunity that we have now is to awaken. We're not just helpless victims of conditioning, no matter what that conditioning might be. Because we all have this potential, this ability to awaken, to observe. Observe what? Well, what we can observe in the present. One thing is to recognize, to begin to operate more from the sense of open attention and whatever comes up in your consciousness. To observe it rather than to try to control it, follow it, or try to suppress it. The attention then, instead of like most of us are, by cultural conditioning, we're programmed to go outward, to seek things externally, like a paradise, a utopian world, a happiness, there's something out there. Success, worldly success. That's how, you know, our education, our whole society operates, from encouraging us to go out, to get wisdom out of books, to get something from somebody else, because we operate from the sense of I'm just this one physical, limited human being. I am, you know, we might see ourselves in a negative way or as not good enough, or something wrong, something missing. I used to think before I encountered Buddhism that I was born without a screw is loose or something in me. I wasn't born complete. Because I never felt, you know, I never could fit in very well. I never felt a part of anything. You know, even the family, because you never seem to be able to feel any sense of connection, because my generation, we were very much encouraged to think of ourselves first. And then you're always comparing yourself with some model, if you think, somebody else, some male or female figure that you think is better than you are, some role model, or maybe a saint-like figure, or with the Buddha, or with something high up. always better. Like you can, we can conceive perfection through thinking. You know, your ability to think, you can create superlative adjectives, the very best, you know, the highest. Everything's fair, everything's just, everything's equal, everybody's free, everybody's happy. We can create, we have the ability to use language to create these images of perfection. But we're not images, we're not ideals, and we have to live within changing conditions. You're not like made out of marble, pure white marble that, you know, is pure in itself, but it doesn't feel anything. Marble statues are beautiful. Some of them, anyway. but you know, they don't feel, they don't have any blood in their veins, they don't have nerves. They don't have, you know, they have kind of eyes, but they don't, eyes can't see anything or feel anything. And yet we compare ourselves with these ideals of perfection, and when you do that, what's the result? You're never going to be that good. Because you're not. None of us are ideals. Ideals don't feel anything. Like the Buddha image here is an ideal, it's an icon. But it doesn't feel anything. But it looks perfect. It's beautiful, and we can be inspired by an ideal. But also reflect, we are not ideals, we're human beings, meaning that we have to survive. We've got, you know, we've got these tendencies for survival, for protecting ourselves, for procreating the species. We have sexual desires. Then we get the programming of our particular cultural identification, our class. We have a sense of belonging to a certain element, or high or low society, nationality, political views, all something we can fight and argue and kill each other around about views about Buddhism. You know, fortunately, Buddhists don't tend towards physical violence. Some do, but the religion itself doesn't promote violence in any way. But if you've lived in the Sangha for very long, you Buddhist monks can have strong views about all kinds of things. Clash endlessly. Because we might be very attached to my particular view of what the Buddha taught, or the training programs we go through and whatnot. Or whether it's Tibetan or Theravada, or I mean, the London Buddhist Society, when I first went to live in London in 1977, they were always, are you Theravada? Are you Zen? And everybody who go to the summer school in the summer there, and he's Zen and he's Tibetan. Everybody was, and they all had their views about which was the best. So then they, because I first became interested in Buddhism through Zen Buddhism. I was one of those kind of that generation in the 50s, the beatnik kind of influence, Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, and you know, you kind of, I was in the Navy in Japan where I encountered Zen Buddhism there. And so, in my interest developed from that early period, which was available, you know, at that time, you know, home port for the ship was San Francisco. So when we'd get into San Francisco, I'd go to bookshops and I found this book called Zen Buddhism by D.T. Suzuki. And people bought it immediately and went out to Golden Gate Park and read it. I was so inspired by that, because it seemed so an opportunity to not just operate from the rigidity of my conditioned thoughts and habits. It offered an alternative way of looking at something, which before I didn't, I felt there was something inadequate about the way I experienced life, because it was so dualistic, you know, it was very fixed, right and wrong, good or bad, and yet intuitively I thought there has to be more this is how I'm conditioned to think and judge and create in my mind through this dualistic thought pattern. But then, of course, Zen Buddhism was interested in paradox and challenging the thinking mind rather than just programming them with the same old stuff. So then in the Buddhist summer school, you started out with Zen Buddhism. Why? Why did you become Theravada? And so I think they're expecting me to say something, you know, about the superiority of Theravada. You know, because, you know, once I started out with Zen, why didn't I stay with that? And then oftentimes Theravada is some beginner's practice, they're not quite as good as the rest. So I said, well, you know, the real reason I became Theravada was because, you know, I really was aimed at, I was in the Peace Corps, 1963, and I was in Saba, North Borneo, and equatorial country, and this brought me into Southeast Asia, and then, of course, Thailand was nearby, so opportunities to go holidays, vacations to Thailand and Cambodia, and I began to take an interest in Theravada through just being in Southeast Asia. So then I said, why did you become Theravada if you were Zen? And I said, well, because, you know, when I was in the Navy, have you ever been in Japan in the wintertime? It's incredibly cold. And I heard that in Zen monasteries they don't heat them. And Thailand is a nice warm country. That's why I chose Theravada. That's true. There wasn't kind of, you know, some wise thing in me that realized the superiority of Theravada, but merely some, you know, not wanting to face a Japanese winter on heated monasteries. But also, living in Southeast Asia, and as I became more acquainted with Theravada and scripture, I began to appreciate that. And so after the 2-year contract with the Peace Corps, I went to live in Thailand, and it led up to this moment. Now, the thinking, our ability to think, is a gift, so I'm not, disparaging it, but pointing out its limitation. It's a critical function. Thinking is about comparing one thing with another. You know, this is big, this is small, this is right, wrong. And so it has its purpose. You know, reason and logic are good tools to develop and so forth. And in worldly life, we use this critical function, but it turns against ourselves so much in modern life because we judge ourselves too as being right or wrong, good or bad, according to maybe the ideals we have. What is the experience of guilt? People have a strong sense of guilt complexes. Where does that come from? Why are so many rather good people who possibly, I don't think most people I know have done anything all that bad to feel guilty about, but they do. And they become obsessed with something they did in the past or all kinds of feelings of worthlessness or whatever, because they might have bad thoughts or they're not, you know, they don't live up to this ideal of perfection. And so you'll never, because you're not an ideal, as I said before, you'll never be that good. But you can be aware of the way things are in the present. And then your relationship to phenomena is no longer trying to control phenomena, control conditions and trying to create the self into some ideal of perfection, we never succeed, to observing the way things are. And so, you know, you don't even need to know why you feel angry or feel guilty or fear and things like this. All you need to know is whatever is going on at this moment, it's the reality of change. All conditions are impermanent. That the Buddha was only interested in the nature of phenomena, not in the quality of it. Where the thinking mind is interested in the quality of the phenomena. You know, it's high or low, good or bad, right or wrong, beautiful or ugly. So contemplate that. The thinking mind can take us to a certain level. It can inspire. We get inspired by high-minded thinking, by role models, by icons, by hearing the stories of famous saints or arahants or whatever. We can, or the life of the Buddha, or Jesus Christ, or whatever. We can be inspired through thinking. But inspiration is a condition changing. You can't sustain it. You know, it's necessary in the beginning, otherwise you wouldn't be here. If there was no inspiration or interest in Buddhism or Buddhist meditation, why would you come to a place like this? But you can't sustain that level of inspiration because it's a changing condition, but you can know it. You can be aware of inspiration. You can be aware of feeling guilty. You can be aware of seeing yourself as not good enough or inadequate. I don't know, you're teaching people how to meditate for so many years. So many people, you know, are quite diligently working at it. Then they feel, I'm getting nowhere in my practice. I'm not a good meditator. I've heard people not practice 20 years now, and I haven't achieved anything. What's wrong with me? So this is very good people too. You know, diligent, hardworking, morally good people. Yet they haven't really seen what they're doing. They may believe in what the teacher tells them, or they follow exactly what somebody else tells them to do. But they aren't observing what they're doing. They're just operating from what the information they get from a meditation master, or from the scripture, or the teacher. Which is good, you know, it's not to be despised, but it won't take you, and it won't liberate you until you see what you're actually doing, what you're attached to. This view of yourself, like master and disciple. Like with Lungpa Cha, he was brilliant at this, because when I first went to stay with him, I looked at him and you're the enlightened master, and I'm your ignorant disciple. You know, so that's how I felt on a personal level. You know, you're the one that made this real, and so, you know, I want you to show me the way, and then I'm your disciple. But Lungpa Cha always had this ability to because I had a language difficulty at first, because of my inability to speak Thai, or understand it. And he couldn't speak any English. But he was also very intuitive. You know, he was awake, fully awake, and even, you know, I was the first Western person to ever, probably that he ever met in his life, because we lived in a remote part of Thailand. But he could see, you know, he knew the nature of the human mind. And at first he kind of encouraged me to inspire me and help me in that, playing the role of master. But eventually he kept pointing out this, you know, I really wanted him to tell me. I wanted him to confirm my attainments. I wanted him to tell me where I'm wrong, tell me where I'm right, what to do next. And he wouldn't play that game. He kept throwing me up, you know, making me look at what I'm actually doing. What was I doing then? And you know, so as a projection onto him, you know, I don't know, that's a creation I make in my mind. You know me better than I know me. That's what it was about. You're the master, I'm the ignorant disciple, you know. And I want you to tell me what to do. And so this was, you know, and he kept, he wouldn't confirm that. You know, so, and he had certain ways, it's hard to describe how he could change me to look at what I'm actually doing. That I'm creating, I'm projecting something onto him at the moment. I'm operating from a perception of myself at the moment. And as I began to awaken to that, what I was actually doing, you know, then I could actually see the suffering I was creating in my my life. It wasn't because of him. It was because of me operating from this basic ignorance of not understanding the nature of phenomena and identifying with these conventional roles, because on a conventional level he was the master. He was the senior monk. He was, you know, he'd been practicing meditation. He was a very wise person. He had all the credentials. I was just, you know, American who happened to turn up and was, you know, had lived an impeccable life, really, and had all kinds of self-doubts and feelings of inadequacy. And yet, through that, life living with Rinpoche, it was, you know, I began to see the illusion that I was operating from. And once you actually observe it, you let it go. It's not, you don't let it go because you don't observe it. You're merely operating, you're meditating, your relationship with others, the whole world around you, operates from a distortion of reality. And we don't see it that way. We operate from certain assumptions, attitudes, biases, prejudices, and that we maybe have never questioned or seen or recognized, that we're holding on to these creations that we make, and then the result will always be some sense of dis-ease, unhappiness, anxiety or worry, or self-hatred. So, satipatthana then is Pali word. The Buddha, after his enlightenment, that the gate to the deathless are open. And I always found this very inspiring, the scripture. Aparuta de sangamatasa taura. Amatasa taura, the gate, the immortal, to immortality. Amatasa, the gate, the door to immortality, to the deathless. Now, thinking is about death. Thinking arises and ceases. You can't conceive anything that is deathless, unconditioned, unborn. We have fantasies about immortal gods, but they all have forms, and we assume that they're born and they'll never die. But these are creations of the human mind. You know, these are what human beings create, but that's not the way things are. What the Buddha was pointing to was that anything that begins ends, everything that arises ceases. And you don't need to know this about everything in the universe, but it's always pointing here, like Lumbhoto was saying, the world arises and ceases here. And he'd say things like, the end of the world is here. He'd point, not to himself, not to Charles, the end of the world, but It's like pointing here. But here is where you actually feel it, the heart chakra, you know, where you, this is the experience of happiness and sadness and everything like that. Up here, it's all rational. You know, you can think and create ideals with thoughts, with intelligence. This is where, in the heart chakra, the heart level, is where we feel so much. We're these sensitive forms, we're in this realm of continuous sensory impingement. And sensitivity doesn't mean just pleasant sense experience, does it? So much of our life is unpleasant, painful. And so the Buddha then takes this condition of dukkha or suffering, puts it into the context of a noble truth, which is always fascinated me, because he took something none of us want. Nobody wants suffering. We want happiness, we want security, we want love, we don't want suffering. We want to get rid of suffering, or run away from it. And then the Buddha takes this common experience to all of us, you know, that everyone can recognize suffering. It's not mystical or metaphysical or remote. It's here and now, just the feeling of aversion or doubt or worry or whatever, you know, at this moment. It doesn't need to be any intense form of suffering. Just feeling this uncertain or ill at ease or restless and being caught up in reactivity to it. Putting that in the context of the First Noble Truth. So I used to ask myself, what is so noble about suffering? The nasty fact, as far as I was concerned, nasty fact of life. And I remember as a little boy thinking, why did God create suffering? I was brought up as a Christian, so if God created everything, why did God create suffering? And I never got an adequate answer. Well, my parents were a priest. But then the Buddha takes suffering, and then what is it? What's noble about it? It isn't that suffering is noble. The noble truth is because we change our relationship to suffering. From seeing it in terms of something's wrong, trying to find happiness, trying to get rid of it, blaming our suffering on others, running around trying to find security or love from others, and suffering, wanting to, as soon as we suffer, we want to distract ourselves from it, find happiness or some kind of relief from it, but not through understanding. Now, to understand something, you have to accept it. You know, if you just keep reacting to suffering all the time by refusing to look at it, understand it, or recognize it, and always blaming it on somebody else or something else, you'll never understand suffering. And taking this common experience, very banal, ordinary experience that we can identify with, you don't have to be high-minded or, you know, have a special karmic connection to the spiritual realm, but just the ordinary human being. And what the Buddha said, understand it. To understand it, we must recognize it and look at it, not in terms of personal identity anymore, but it's like this feeling of guilt or doubt or worry. We're aware of it. Or we feel anger. You feel angry, you say, I'm angry. But what is it that is aware of anger, aware of worry and doubt, unhappiness? That's Sati Sampajanya. And that isn't, Sati Sampajanya doesn't worry about anything. And it's pure consciousness. It's not like a kind of something you create, you know, through through manufacturing more refined thoughts in your mind, but it's through understanding. You recognize. And this is your refuge in awareness, in Buddha, in Dhamma, Sangha. These are the words we use in this tradition. And so then you ask yourself this, you say some emotion like anger, which is quite obvious. It's a primal emotion, you know, it's part of the package. You know, this is, that's about self-preservation, it's about survival and things like this, you know. So anger and greed are, you know, it's like sexual desire is a natural condition. And it's part of the package of being a human being, you know. We wouldn't be here if there wasn't any sexual desire. And yet, our relationship to anger or desire is through the critical mind. You know, I shouldn't get angry. Or you're the one that makes me angry. Or sexual desire is, we have various views about it being good, pure, bad, wrong, dirty. And, you know, so we form an identity with a sexual drive, and we have, feel guilty maybe, or caught up in anger, we might want to get rid of it. How do we conquer anger? I've heard that question asked many times. But we're not interested in why or who's at fault, but that when the conditions for anger arise in our lives, this is what we feel. And we're aware of that feeling. That's quite a strong one. Or sexual desire. We're aware when the conditions for that kind of desire are present. We're aware of it. And that which is aware is not angry or desired. It's not desiring anything, but it's knowing, it's understanding, it's recognizing phenomena in terms of its changing nature rather than in terms of personal conditioning of right, wrong, good or bad. So this is like, this is to be able to change from someone who's always claiming that these conditions are me and my problems, to say that there's anything wrong with that, but it's misleading because that's not really what the problem is. It's this ignorance in terms of Dhamma, not awakening to reality. So I've been going on for an hour. But so the main point of this evening is like a reflective talk, and to encourage you, because we all need encouragement. You know, we can, the monastic life, and no matter how dedicated you are, we can, you know, if we get discouraged, the world is very powerful. Modern society, the work ethic, the capitalist free market system, the political problems of the United States and the world around us. I mean, our own relationships, our marriages, or whatever, very strongly, take us over, and we get lost in those conditions. Not to suppress them, but to understand, to change from being someone who is always trying to get rid of suffering, or trying to, what do I do to get rid of it? It's to understanding it, seeing that the cause of it is ignorance, not understanding it in terms of what it really is in the present moment. What is it in the present moment? Is the condition changing? Anything like that. If you're really patient and willing to accept whatever you're feeling, you see, it has no sustainability. Is learning to accept it for what it is, and you'll observe changing, and you'll observe it ceasing here. And then you'll also observe non-anger. See, so there's wisdom there. You're offering, you're not just dealing with anger anymore, but you're also becoming consciously knowing of non-anger, non-desire, and pure consciousness, which is non-personal. It's not me anymore. Consciousness has no boundary. It's not in me, as if it was contained within the limitations of my body, but it's expansive. It's what we're all experiencing. It's not personal. So after this, as a reflection, and if there's time to open it up to questions, or anyone have a question? But it's I mean, this is something like the Buddha's, like interconnected consciousness and things like this are kind of modern terms. That when, you know, when the Buddha gave the teaching, it's based on just some very obvious fact that we have suffering, and that takes us by using suffering, we explore it. And then consciousness, in Buddhist terms, is one of the immeasurables. It has no boundary. And so, in like in conditioned knowledge, it's all about the solid element, fire, air, and the liquid, earth, fire, water, air, and there's space and consciousness. And my in interest in consciousness, because in Theravada teaching, sometimes it's the word for consciousness, vijnana, is used in different contexts. And so it's included in what they call the five khandhas, which are all impermanent and not self. And consciousness, then, in terms of not self, is out of it. Then, in terms of the five khandhas, you know, we're experiencing consciousness through the body, through the eyes, through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. And these are all the elements of earth, fire, water, and air. Then as you know, the Buddha clearly stated, there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. And if there was not the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there would be no escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. But because there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there is the escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. This is an affirmation of reality. It's a brilliant way of putting it. Like, you can imagine anything form, created, condition. Yeah, you can, it can be abstract, it can be a form that you, like a cup or a table, something. It could be just a color or various things, but conditioned phenomena is all about impermanence and non-self. But you can't create an image of the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. Like I've tried, it's just working with my own mind. Can I imagine something unborn and unformed? My thinking mind stops. It can't conceive of that. It uses a negative, unborn, unformed, an abstraction. Word, that's an abstract word, but it has. But then consciousness is reality now. It's not something you lack. It's here and now. And so you don't need to define consciousness or create an image of it. Just wake into it. It's like this. This is consciousness. And then like space too. You know, like just visually. You're in space, space is all around you, but you may never really notice it. You know, I just did in the shrine, in the teacher, and the people, and the color of the walls, or whatever. You go from one thing to another, but that which is really present here and now, that's most important to this event, is space. You know, if this room didn't have any space, we couldn't be in it together. It's the most important element. And consciousness, and there's no, somebody unconscious couldn't hear anything I'm saying. So, and yet space and consciousness are immeasurables. And trying to define immeasurables is an impossibility. Because definition always comes through thinking, through comparing one thing with another. So you do have, you know, you think, well, maybe unborn and born are opposites. You know, and then the unborn, they might go out into the logic of that is the unborn is better than the born. That doesn't make any sense. It's not about better, it's about the way it is. And so when you feel, when you're creating something in your mind, a thought or feeling, or calling in seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, etc. You're dealing with a form, and then you know you don't. If you just that's for your reality, then you're always going from one thing to another, one form to another. So then you. But then when you stop just doing that and observing the form is changing, and that which is aware of change. Doesn't come and go. Maybe your ability to trust it and recognize it comes and goes, your attention comes and goes. But it's always present here and now. Whatever, whether you're sick or healthy, asleep or awake or whatever. And so, you know, when we want to. When we think of Theravada Buddhism, there's no kind of oneness, interconnected. We talk a lot about one point in this. Ekakatta, citta, one point in. And then the easy interpretation is just like I said before, focusing on one object and excluding everything else. So then, you know, we usually choose a refined object, like, you know, if you use Anapanasati, you will, you know, you, as you more you concentrate on breathing, it'll refine and even disappear. You'll feel very tranquil. But, and that's, you know, that's something worth doing. But then the thing, immediately when you aren't focusing on the breath, all this comes back again. And so you maybe get attached to tranquility. You want to become a control freak. You want to control everything, so you have this wonderful feeling. But the Buddha, you see, was enlightened not through controlling, but through understanding. And then this one point in the thinking, Gata Chitta, instead of focusing on one object to the exclusion of it, it's including. Now this, you can't imagine. It includes the sun and the moon, all the stars, everything. And yet, you know, our identification is so limited to the mortal forms that we're so identified with that we can't really comprehend that much. So, for the Buddha, there's this handful of these. Just, you don't need to know about, we're not God that knows everything about everything, but we just need to know the nature of conditioned phenomena as we experience it, in whatever way that is, you know. It's not about, you know, understanding the sun and moon and the vast universe around you, but just developing that wisdom through observing changes you're experiencing in the present, which can be kind of subtle or, you know, it can be strong or weak, but conditions are, whatever their qualities, they're changing. Your awareness of change, that's what you trust. When you start, like I find, when I see consciousness as oneness, because like my cultural condition is always consciousness in my brain, you know, it's in me, it's mine. And your consciousness is in your brain. Your consciousness is yours, not mine. But that creates this incredible separation all the time. We're always operating from the separative conditions of identifying with the body, with memories, because you're going to have different memories than I do, different emotional habits, and so forth. And these are all different, you know. So we can emphasize these differences, and then, you know, get caught up with our own personal views about what I think yours are and what you think of mine. But if we let go of all that, then what remains is pure consciousness, which is unity. It's universal. These kind of words, they make sense. And then, it's a way, you know, like they're talking about nature and environmental problems and then the conflicts between the Sunnis and Shias and the Israelis and the Palestinians and the Republicans and the Democrats. And there's no context for oneness in our culture. It's about I'm right, you're wrong, you've got it all wrong, ours is right. And that's, you know, so then we fight and argue, and it's usually power struggling, you know, who can win, you know, I can, you know, win over you, I'm going to be more powerful than you are. But if there's this oneness, then there's a respect for life, you know, for everything, for nature itself, for the universe, because it's a sense of wholeness, it's not a sense of my environment or my thought, my view is right. It's beyond that. And then right and wrong are, you know, that's the convention. Things that are right and wrong according to conditions. There's no absolute right and wrong good or bad. These qualities change according to the conditions we find ourselves in. And then mindfulness is our ability to actually be aware of the conditions. So then if I'm trust the awareness, then I'm more aware of you, what you particularly need or at this time, rather than just preaching at you how you should meditate and in your life. I may be right, you know, my advice might be absolutely good advice, but if I'm coming from the, you know, me telling you what you should do, what are you feeling? You know, you're feeling my arrogance, you know, what I'm saying is right. But if there's wisdom, then I can, you know, I can assess when you're open to such advice or when you're not. And that's conditioning. It's not, you know, it's not something that is absolute anymore. But this is what, you know, because I've been approached on many, you know, in the Theravada tradition about my attitudes towards consciousness. And so, you know, I feel like I'm actually, you know, from my own experience, this is what I recognize. And if I just operate from trying to fit personal interpretations of scriptures, and just operate from the way I read Pali scriptures, and then you don't agree with me, then I'm trying to make you fit into my perceptions of the teaching of the Buddha. Where if where the Buddha is talking about awakening, not about kind of instilling in you Buddhist ideas so you become a Buddhist and then agree with whatever Buddha says, but, you know, why did he choose suffering as a noble truth? Because it's so ordinary. And it's not, you know, it's not because God did something wrong or something wrong. It's just the nature of phenomena. And in a way, when you begin to recognize that, you can accept that. Where if, on a personal level, you know, we feel sometimes indignant or angry because life is so unfair and unjust, and it shouldn't be like that. And, you know, we should love each other and not fight and argue and kill each other. We should, you know, we all know how the American government should be. Or how the Israelis and Palestinians should be. We all know that from an ideal level. But this is what the way it is. And that doesn't mean accepting or justifying or approving. It doesn't mean approving or justifying. But it's recognizing these are conditions changing. And if more of us awaken to that reality, then these conflicts can be resolved more through wisdom than through power structure, through dominance, or annihilation. One way to get rid of their things we don't like is to annihilate them. But that creates even more problems. Yes. Somebody.
Thanks for coming and spending some time with us. And I was sitting here and wondering if you'd be willing to share any thoughts that you have about really the relationship between the lay community and the monastic community. I appreciate that this is a place that you've sat and looked at from a different perspective for 50 years, and you've seen that relationship in Thailand, and you've seen it in England, and where do we see each other well, and where don't we see each other, and what can we learn from what it's like from your side of that relationship?
Well, you know, I've developed through the monastic form. So I can speak with authority through that, but it's a form. And then to try to put form into perspective, like forms are conditions. So monastic form is a condition, like any other form. But it's not a condition that we're, you know, it's a condition to use for mindfulness, not a condition to identify or cling to as an identity. And so then it's highly developed way, like I find in monastic life, you know, it gives me a chance to live with other monks, and other times on, you know, we all agree to pretty much live under the same discipline. So like Ajahn Chah is very kind of strict in developing the Vinaya discipline, which is, you know, quite a lot of rules. And so we train ourselves within that structure, which, you know, makes our life much easier, actually, because our relationships are agreed on, you know, how we relate to each other. Non-violent, and we're always meant because we depend on the lay community for basic necessities. And then we have, it's all structured according to who ordained first. You know, Senor is not personal anymore. It's not who is the best monk or who is the Arahant and who isn't. It's the whole structure is based on who's senior. And so that's the way it makes our life easier because we always know what to do. It's not up to me to think that monk, you know, he's senior to me, but I, you know, it's not any good. So I'm not going to I mean, if he isn't any good, still perform the duty because it's the structure we agreed to. And actually, that makes our relationship how we can live with each other and still, on a personal level, we can not agree on all kinds of things, you know, personal views and opinions can, and you know, we can still argue and create problems around our personal views of Dhamma and Vinaya and practice and so forth. But we stick together because of the structure holds them. And last May we had a meeting in Amaravati in England. You know, we have these meetings every 5 years or so. And this year it was in England, and there were about 8 monks from everywhere, from, you know, Australia, Europe, and America, and so forth. 8 and 29 different nationalities. And yet we're, as a whole, kind of a form, we have this one form we agreed to. So it makes us, we aren't negotiating our own terms on the form. This is accepted. We do it by faith. And then we can deal with our personal differences. But it doesn't divide, usually doesn't divide it. Some monks have strong views that carry that they want to separate, so they go their own way. That's their business. But actually, the form, it allows difference. It's not about, you don't have to think alike or feel alike. I mean, that would be impossible. But it is, you know, in terms of living together, we trust each other. You know, I trust that, you know, maybe they disagree with me on one level, but they're not going to lie to me or, you know, kill me or steal from me or do things like that. And so, it's a sense of trust within a community of different personalities. For the lay community, you've got, you know, it's like in the States, everything's so individualistic. You know, everything's about me and what I think and my right and what I feel. And that is very difficult to really harmonize with anyone else when you're placing your own views about, you know, you've got to agree with me, I don't want anything to do with you kind of way. But in the terms of structure, you know, the moral position of like 5 precepts or things like, we're in a tradition like different forms of Buddhism, you agree to live within the structures that those offer. Like it was the Tibetan or Theravada Zen. Then you can deal with the differences, the personal differences, emotional reactions to yourself. And that's important because the whole aim of the life is this mindfulness, to be aware of what we're doing. Not to, you know, if I think I'm right, I'm going to argue with you and tell you you're wrong, you know, I can, this is my logical ability and I'm attached to it. And this could cause you and I to have personal conflict. But if my main interest is in mindfulness, I'm going to see this in myself, you know, see my attachment to my view or what I think and how it doesn't align with yours and the kind of feeling of wanting to, maybe I want to win my argument and put you down, or I just feel if you don't agree with me, I want nothing more to do with you. I can be aware of all this going on. And when you see that, you let go. Not worth it. You know? I don't want to convert anybody or bend people to my will. you know, it's a matter of developing wisdom. And, you know, it's like meditation groups and, you know, people have different views. And there's always conflict within any group. You know, it's just the nature of human society. But we could use that. You know. It's like here, the Seattle Insight meditation. You know, thing to do is this, not to, you don't have to like and agree with everything, you know, but what I would do is just say, it's like this, you know, it's a way of just accepting the thing for what it is, even if or how you feel about it, it's like this. And then you can deal with, you know, your own emotional reactions to the teachers or the things that happen. But if you don't, if you're always trying to want this organization to be more what you think it should be, even though you might have very good ideas, it will cause division and conflict. And you'll never see what you're actually doing. And that's where, you know, we. So that's the point, is we want to, you know, my whole interest in this life has been to break through all the things that make me separate and that cause me suffering. No matter what, you know, whether it's, you know, right or wrong, good or bad. And then, you know, in this life, I, you know, people praise me and they have a very, you know, project a lot onto me as being, you know, highly regarded and so forth. This is praise. And I personally like to be praised, you know. And then other times I've been blamed and criticized. And, you know, people, they, you know, just trust others and they don't know what he's talking about or things like this. And then, and I don't like to be criticized. That's personal. That's not the way things are, that's just my personal, how my personality works. But in terms of mindfulness, then you learn, and when people praise you, you recognize the feelings that arise and see. And when you're being blamed for something, you recognize the feelings that arise and see. So you learn to use everything that happens to you. You know, you're no longer concerned about being criticized or rejected, or if you are worried about it, you can have a perspective to deal with that experience. And then not to get lost in the, you know, this great monk that has done so much, because, you know, people talk about me like that, but I personally don't feel that, you know. What's happened seems to have happened, you know, and it surprises me, because it's not, I personally didn't have any intention to be in this position. You know, it isn't a plan I figured out, put in my mind to make it happen. And so I don't feel personally that, you know, even though people identify with me, I don't know. That on a personal level I like to be respected and loved and everything. like this. I don't have that or expect it. So you're learning to open yourself to the whole universe in a way that will carry you through your whole life. Because how do you know how much, you know, your health, how that will be, or whether people love you or hate you, or your success or failure, or whatever. These things change. We don't have that much control over all these changing things. But we can use change. This is what the Buddha was pointing to, this of how we can see change from this perspective of wisdom rather than in terms of personal feelings of like and dislike. So, time for me to...